I'm Dr. Noah Emery.
I'm Sam Acuff.
And this is the Addiction Psychologist Podcast, brought to you by the Society of Addiction Psychology. Today, we're going to talk with Dr. Lorraine Collins. Lorraine is the Associate Dean for Research in the School of Public Health and Health Professions at the University of Buffalo. She's also a professor in the Department of Community Health and Health Behavior. And we're going to have her join us to talk about ecological momentary assessment and cannabis use. Lorraine, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Noah.
Yeah, we're really excited to have you here. Could you tell us a little bit about your training?
All right. Well, I'll start with my university training. I grew up in Montreal, Canada, and I had the pleasure of going to McGill University, where I got my undergraduate degree in psychology. And from McGill, I applied and got into Rutgers University, which at the time was the number one on my list because they had a behaviorally oriented PhD program. And there weren't programs like that in Canada at the time. And so I was very excited to get into Rutgers. And I earned my master's and later my PhD at Rutgers. Because I'm a clinical psychologist, I had to do an internship. And I did that at the University of Washington in Seattle, in their Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences, and loved Seattle so much that I was looking around for opportunities to stay and lucked into a postdoc with Alan Marlett. I was the kind of project manager, project director of a grant of his, and spent 2 years in Seattle doing a postdoc.
Wow, fantastic. Wow. Yeah, that's a real... Alan Marlett showed up quite a few times now on the show. Such a great
lineage. So true.
You're probably like the third or fourth person who has had some connection to Alan that's been on the show, which has been his footprint on the field still comes from beyond. So it's always great to hear that.
Yes, it's part of that Alan Marlett family. And you know, there are others who came after me and we still connect, and it's an amazing contribution that Alan made.
And he was such a prolific researcher. I think what maybe is not understood as well, and I never met him, but it's so clear that he must have been an amazing mentor as well, just because of the types of impacts, the types of things that his students and postdocs go on to do. So, well, today we want to talk a lot. You know, you've done, as we were talking before we hopped on the recording, you've had your hands in a lot of different things over the years that have made a huge impact on our field. But today we're going to sort of narrow in on some of your work specifically related to cannabis use and ecological momentary assessment. And we were wondering if we could just start, you've done specifically a lot of work related to emotionality, positive and negative mood, and its association with cannabis use. And, you know, there's a pretty large body of evidence out there that demonstrates these associations, but most of that data is cross-sectional in nature. What are we kind of missing when we are not looking at this longitudinally?
So whether it's cannabis or alcohol, where I also did a lot of research looking at the role of affect, what we're missing is the situational variation that can occur. So the cross-sectional data captures a moment, or even if it's retrospective, it might capture a guesstimate of what was going on. What we get with real-time data collection is all of the variation that can occur as we know in ourselves and in the people we study.
Yeah, that's a really good point because, you know, our mood shifts not, you know, not only over periods of months, but also within moments, right? From 1 minute to the next, or from 1 hour to the next.
That's why we call it momentary assessment, because we know that, you know, something can trigger a negative or positive mood. It's kind of interesting. There often is consistency. I've seen it in myself when I've run my own EMA protocols just to see what's going on. And you do have people who seem to come across as being more positive or being more negative. But even within that general designation of mood, you will get variation. And so to the extent that we want to really understand what's going on momentarily, something that might trigger substance use or not, then it's really useful to have the momentary pieces.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like that can help bypass some of these problems. And specifically, you mentioned one component of data that you get out of EMA is within person variation. You can see how they sort of change over time and also how consistent they are. Mm-hmm. So can you just talk a little bit broadly about EMA, what maybe a typical study looks like or a typical protocol looks like, and in the types of data, the types of questions that you can answer?
Okay. Wow. That's a huge question.
Yeah.
Okay. So first of all, ecological momentary assessment has been around since the 90s. And the idea, as I've been explaining, has to do with wanting to capture what's going on in real time. I got involved in EMA data collection with Saul Schiffman, who was one of the people who developed this approach. And he was looking at tobacco use, and I knew Saul as a colleague. And after I heard a talk that he gave, I came up to him and I said, we've got to apply that to alcohol. And so that's got me started. And now obviously we've moved on to cannabis. But what EMA allows us to do is to look within person as well as between people, because if you have, you know, X number of people in your cohort, let's say in an intervention study, you can look at people in condition A versus people in condition B cumulatively, just the way that you can look in, you know, within an individual. So it really provides opportunities at different levels. So one study that we did with cannabis that involved EMA and an intervention was conducted in Buffalo. And what we did is we collected EMA as well as provided intervention content in an app. So that's one of the things about this approach, is it uses a lot of technologies. And so what we were able to do is we assigned people to two different conditions, and we had them come in for weekly intervention sessions. But we also had them engage with the app basically 24/7 for the duration of the intervention. And the app collected the typical EMA moods, cannabis use, what happened before and after they used cannabis, what time they went to bed. We end up knowing a lot about these folks. But along with that, the app also provided opportunities for them to self-monitor. So for example, one of the things that really had an impact on our participants was asking them about the money they spent on cannabis. And our app would graph it. And so they would see their weekly expenditures on cannabis. And that was a revelation to a lot of them. So not only were they monitoring their cannabis use and saying, whoa, that's great, I'm going down, but they would be able to look back and say, wow, I was spending $200 a week on cannabis. That's a car payment or what have you. Because again, these are young adults and it's not like they had a ton of money. And so one of the things that I liked about this particular version of our app was that it allowed for self-monitoring. It gave continuous feedback. It also had intervention components so that they could tap on a menu and get tips. You know, a tip might be to, you know, go take a walk as a way of relieving stress, or, you know, what physical activity actually was a big part of the intervention. So that's why I mentioned that. But there were other tips from kind of a cognitive behavioral perspective that were available to them. So what they got each week in the intervention was also available on the app. And it was very useful, successful over time. And we got a pub out of it. They're kind of a menu of things that we include in our EMA, but we have random prompting so that 3 or 4 times a day, we'll just prompt them to say, what's going on? You know, how are you feeling? Who are you with? What activities are you engaging in? That's a random prompt. Then the other thing we ask them to, so that's us kind of reaching out to our participants. The other thing we ask them to do is to self-monitor and tell us what's going on. So for example, we're not going to be able to know when they're about to use cannabis, but we ask them or we train them to start reporting on their cannabis use right at the beginning of an episode. And so we train them to say, before you start using or as soon as you start using, please respond to these questions. And again, it might be mood, it might be how much you plan to smoke, who are you with, what activities are you engaging in? And then we also ask them at the end of that episode, what's going on? Again, what's your mood? How much did you smoke? How high do you feel? Who are you with? What activities are you engaging in? So we really have rich data related to each episode of cannabis use. So again, we've got the self-monitoring where the participant initiates and we've got the prompting. Now the prompting is important because that provides a context for understanding what happens at the episode level. So with mood, for example, if you just look at the episode and you see that negative affect is related to smoking a joint, you might conclude, oh, they're smoking in response to negative affect. With the random prompt, you get a context in which to think about what's going on. And so the random prompting really provides like a baseline view of that person's emotional life. And what you might find with the random prompting is, wait a second, they're always in a negative mood. Huh. It's not just related to using cannabis. That's just where they're at right now.
Right.
And so it's really, really useful to have both that broader context as well as the specific triggers.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that's one of the most beautiful parts about EMA and EMA data is that it allows you to basically stitch together a person's day, right? And all the different parts that kind of gone on there through the random sampling of moments throughout their day. And then also situation specific moments that, of interest, like, you know, a substance use episode. And you're able to be able to look at, you know, like before they started using, how were they feeling? And how is that different than perhaps how they typically feel? Mm-hmm. And, you know, how is that related to substance use? And then how does substance use perhaps then affect their mood afterwards, right? Like,
right.
You know, the idea behind this is, you know, at least historically, is that, you know, substance is supposed to make you feel better, right? And sometimes that's true and sometimes it's not. And I think EMA is probably well positioned to tell us a little bit about that, but it also allows us to look at, you know, treatment mechanisms, right? Yes. That are going on at the within person, you know, within day level. You know, when does it take effect? Under what conditions does it take effect? And that's often missing from a traditional kind of randomized clinical trial.
that level of specificity. Also the temporal ordering of things, right? So like which came first, the chicken or the egg part, right? Really allows us, I think, to get nuanced looks at things. And so I was curious a little bit about, you know, how do you think that this has really helped us kind of move the field forward in cannabis use? Like, is there any, you know, specific things you think has really kind of been stood out to you?
So we are so far behind when it comes to understanding cannabis use. I can't
that's
even.
A, that's a really important
begin. Yeah. Oh my
gosh. People are just barely starting to, I think, do things that we did 20 years ago for alcohol.
Yeah. Alcohol and tobacco are way ahead. And so actually you could probably make a career just replicating alcohol and tobacco research and with cannabis and finding somewhat similar, but also different relationships and associations. But yes, cannabis is kind of like alcohol in the sense that use is situational. But what's different about cannabis is all the ways in which you can use it. So tobacco and alcohol pretty much you use orally, and with cannabis, obviously you can smoke it, you can eat it, you can vape it. They use oils, they use, you know, dabs. It's just the different modes of use for cannabis are kind of astounding when you compare them to what we have with our other, let's say, legal or close to legal substances. I think the other thing related to how they use is metabolizing cannabis. So if people are eating it, they're not going to report being high within 5 minutes, while if they're smoking or vaping it, they might start to feel changes in consciousness relatively quickly, the way you might with tobacco. So it's challenging. It really is challenging because we have a product that is used in multiple ways, that is metabolized in multiple ways, and based on those two things can actually lead to different kinds of reactions, whether it be change in consciousness or affect. It's daunting. It really is daunting. I think the other thing I will add with cannabis is potency. So now, you know, we have products, concentrates, for example, that are up to 90% THC. So in the bad old days in the 70s, it was like 5 to 7% THC. Wow. You know? So we're talking about something that is so variable in so many ways. I think we need something like EMA just to start capturing what people are doing and how they're using it and what kind of effects the different approaches to use can lead to.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really important point. And maybe if we had got EMA in the game in cannabis use 20 years ago, we might have been able to figure a bunch of stuff out about, you know, like smoking cannabis, right?
Yep.
But because this stuff's just barely coming online a lot today, and some people like yourself have been doing it for a while, but it's relatively new to the game compared to, you know, alcohol and EMA or tobacco even, is that now the proliferation, right, of all these different modes of administration, all of which come with their own specific timeline of intoxication, specific subjective and physiological effects on a person's mood, on a person's you know, physiological states like balance and these other types of things. And that's been the real challenge. Just so I'm in Colorado now, and you know, it's a legal cannabis state, and trying to do some of the work that we do, like the whole study is really just like you're talking about, just trying to figure out even like what it is that just fills up the questionnaire so much. Just like all of the different, was it a dab or was it like you know, a concentrate or these different types of things? And I think there's a lot of work to figure all of this stuff out that still remains to be seen. And the potency thing is such a hard thing to isolate because of, you could have the same kind of product that two people are using. And if you just have like a checkbox, like I use concentrates, that's not going to tell you, right? Like somebody might've bought like the most potent concentrate you can get, and that'll have a totally different pattern than somebody who bought perhaps a much less potent concentrate. Right. And so we really got to, I think there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. And the way people use it, there's a lot of co-use, as they call it, with cannabis these days. So combining cannabis with tobacco is very common. Mm-hmm. And that can have different effects, you know, because nicotine's a stimulant, and then you add cannabis to that. And it's we need a lot of really basic research on the kind of pharmacology of cannabis, the pharmacokinetics, pharmacodynamics. It's well beyond what social psychologists can really manage. So I hope some of the pharmacology folks get involved or get more involved.
Yeah. And with changes in legislation, I think that's kind of been the gatekeeper to some of that work. Specifically, right, is that like, as we change, like in Colorado, like you can do those kinds of tests where that would be, you have to get like special permissions to get access to some of these types of things. And I know some people are doing some real interesting stuff, like people at the University of Missouri are doing a thing where like they, and we're doing it here too at CSU, where like we'll pull up in a van and like test, like what you got, like let's test it out. So we can see, or we're having people take pictures of the package when they're buying legal cannabis.
Yes.
And put that into an EMA application so that we can hopefully derive some kind of potency and things. But that still doesn't tell us about the dynamics of it, right? That's a chemistry related thing. And so I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done in this.
And that assumes, by the way, that the state is regulating the labels.
Which they're not.
Often not. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And so, you know, it could say 30% THC and then you test it and it's 3% THC.
Yeah.
You know, expectancies start to play a role on people's reactions, as you know, to drugs. And so if I get something that says 30% THC, my reaction, is going to be different than if I get something that says 3% THC, even though they might have the same amount of THC. So that's another level or layer that has to be considered. When you mentioned pulling up in a van, do you know the work Kent Hutchison is doing?
Yep.
Because he's in Colorado.
Yep. Yeah. So I work with somebody named Dr. Hollis Caraly. Who trained with Kent and is now with us at CSU.
Okay.
And so they've taken Kent and Cinnamon's kind of approach and have applied it to, she has a K award looking at co-use between alcohol and cannabis use. And so we do some mobile, they call it the can van. But I also know, I think it was it like Dennis that. McCarthy or Tim Troll or maybe it was Ken Schur, who was doing some of that kind of stuff too at Mizzou. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's people get creative.
I was going to say that when Kent first talked about what he was doing with these vans, I was like, that is fantastic. To have the creativity, you know, he set it up so that people get their stuff from a retailer who he knows and he can verify. They buy it, they go home, they use it, he pulls up in their driveway, they come out and do whatever the cognitive task or the other kinds of tasks that he has, then they go back. Now, the reason why we have to play these games and be this creative is the federal laws around cannabis. So whatever you decide, you know, that you as a state want, which Colorado I know has decided recreational cannabis is available, you still have to deal with the federal laws. Mm-hmm. And as somebody who gets funded by NIH, for example, you're supposed to be getting your cannabis from NIDA. And they're working on improving it, but it's still low THC. It's still, people complain about the nature of the product. Yeah. They don't have dabs and concentrates or whatever. So we're really hampered by the current state of the federal policies. And until that gets resolved, I think progress is going to be slow.
Yeah. And this is an important point, I think, that needs to be made, is that, right, that like I've seen the quality of this stuff. Like when I was at Brown, Jane Metric had this, and it was like not good.
It's horrible.
Right? Like it was like horrible. Yeah. It was like, who would pay money for this kind of stuff? Like people would laugh, you know, like at it. And that's if you want to do like laboratory studies, right? In a cold environment. And that's the beauty though of EMA, right? Is that like, we can just like let you do whatever you're doing out in your environment. And we could try to get as much contextual information around that. We're not going to be able to get the pharmacokinetics perhaps, right? Which is, you know, and the dynamics of like how it moves through your bloodstream and all that kinds of stuff. But we can get pretty good data on how your subjective effects of intoxication move through time and how that relates to specific behaviors of interest, that we can make some kind of analogs of, you know, specific behaviors like driving or, you know, interpersonal dynamics and things like that. And that's the beauty, I think, of EMA, is that allows us not only to bypass some of these things, but also answer these like within person, temporally important questions as it relates to substance use and frankly, treatment effects.
Yes.
Right. And I think that's really, I think, an underutilized area for EMA. I know I worked at Brown with somebody named Bob Miranda, and he does EMA in the context of clinical trials, and it sounds like you do too.
Yes.
And so I was curious a little bit about where some of your work is heading as it relates to these intervention developments in the EMA space.
So again, we can probably study anything and make a contribution, but I am interested in the whole co-use issue. And right now, so I live in New York State and we have medicinal cannabis. We do not have recreational cannabis. And the governor and the legislature have been seriously playing at this for 3 years. And I'm not optimistic that it will happen this year. But around us, there are various states that are now moving to recreational cannabis. And what that means, I think, especially for young people, is that they use various substances together. So, you know, years ago, there used to be an alcoholic or a smoker. That really does not exist for young people. And the populations I tend to work with are like 18 to 25 year olds. And guess what's happening at that time in life? They're experimenting with whatever. And so I think it's really important to look at co-use. I mean, if you think about intervention, and this I know has always been an issue kind of in traditional alcohol treatment, you know, if they're a smoker and they're also drinking, which one do we intervene with first? And if we get them to stop drinking, is that going to push up their smoking and vice versa? You know, there are questions about interrelationships among substances that are either used in close contiguity or separated or in response to being alone versus being in a social context and so forth and so on. So I am interested in co-use, and I have a grad student who actually just did an MTurk study just to get some beginning information from co-users about what's going on.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. I think that it's the single substance user is an exception to the rule. And I think that's probably how it's always been. It's just that we haven't been studying it, you know, acknowledging that people are using multiple substances. This is a really important thing to understand. And EMA provides the platform for actually looking at moments where someone does co-use versus mm-hmm. when they don't. Do you have any information about that?
We do not at the momentary level. I mean, the MTurk study was more of a survey just right. to understand what's going on. But the key message that I think we're all kind of trying to send with regard to EMA is because we're looking at substance use in a situational fashion, you can capture what's going on and the social context and the emotional context and all these other things. Maybe you mainly use cannabis when you're around your friends, and when you're by yourself, you drink, or vice versa. You know, you drink when in the days when you could go to a bar before COVID,
right?
Maybe you hang out with your friends at the bar and you drink. And then when you go home, you use cannabis. I mean, one of the interesting things that we found in the intervention study, and this was, I think half of our sample were college students. They often smoked alone or vaped mm-hmm. alone. They mm-hmm. would have whatever their day end, you know, whether it be studying or job after school or what have you. And they'd go home and they'd want to relax, kick back. They'd be bored. And that's when they chose to smoke. In a way, that seems less concerning than if an 18-year-old was drinking, you know, 5 vodka shots by themselves at the end of the day. So it's very complicated when we look at, you know, the fact that most people use what's available and vary their use based on contextual factors as, you know, kind of in their environment, as well as emotional, subjective kinds of factors.
Yeah, I think that most people, when they think of substance use and its relationship with mood or emotion, would think primarily, you know, you feel bad and you use, or you're feeling really good and you use, right?
Yep.
I do think that this boredom thing sort of gets skipped over quite a bit.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I completely agree. And that's one of the things that the EMA pointed out to us, because, you know, you would ask people what was going on, and they'd say they're alone. How are they feeling? And it's kind of, not so positive, not so negative. And then you'd ask them reasons for use, and it was boredom. And so that becomes, I think, an important issue for intervention. And, you know, I don't know how long we'll be in COVID lockdown, but I can imagine that being alone as much as people are these days, I mean, we have seen, or people are reporting upticks in alcohol use and so forth, but I would bet that there are upticks in cannabis use around the fact that people feel socially isolated and bored.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting and important point for several reasons. One is that, like, I think the evidence is, I don't know if it's super clear or definitive, but there is some evidence that, like, drinking alone, solitary drinking, is related to having problems, right? And I don't know that that's true for cannabis use, given exactly how often this happens, right? Like, that's kind of like,
yep.
I think in the media portrayal of alcohol use, this is one of those times where the media portrayal of alcohol use perhaps lines up with the evidence in the research for alcohol use, which is like drinking alone tends to be an indicator of problems or ahead, but that's not true for cannabis use. Also COVID, right? Like, so cannabis use is often used in a group, right? A lot of times, as you talked about, but it's also used alone. And I wonder, you know, whether or not people are using more alone, because there's kind of like a pass it around kind of technique that occurs when you're using cannabis that doesn't happen with alcohol, right? Like you kind of each have your own receptacle of alcohol. Whereas when you're using cannabis, it's kind of like everybody's using from the same.
Not anymore.
Not anymore.
No. Right?
And so, really?
Yeah. So that's probably an interesting interrupt in the way that we're doing stuff. And so we're going to have to really appreciate that. And this boredom factor, I think, is such an important layer. I know some of my work showed that, that in a cannabis treatment trial, boredom was one of the strongest predictors of relapse in the clinical trial for teens.
Yep.
And low positive affect at the aggregate level. So on average, people who experience less positive emotion over the clinical trial tended to use more cannabis over the course of treatment. And so I think all of these things are really coming together in a very interesting and important way in COVID times, I guess, that we should probably be really paying attention to.
And I completely agree with you. You know, we both found boredom in the context of interventions with young people. And I think there's maybe almost a generational piece to this, because in the past, the cannabis, especially smoke cannabis, what you described as passing it around, that often was in a party atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And I think that's changed in certain ways. Even things that you can pass, people tend to do that less. And this was probably even with COVID. But, you know, they're not passing vape pens or what have you. And if you're eating it, which some people like because the effects are more mild and take a little bit more time and so forth, if they can manage it. But anyway, there are other modes of use now that don't really lend themselves to being passed.
So it almost sounds like, and I don't think that this is easily studied, but it kind of sounds like it's shifted as like a social phenomenon to something, maybe not, you know, it's not asocial or non-social, but to something else.
Well, there are huge contextual factors in what happens with use. And so, yes, there's probably a context where you're with a lot of friends and you're smoking. Maybe people pass. I don't think that's happening quite as much. And it depends on what they're smoking.
Yeah.
You know, if it's a hookah, then that kind of leads itself to passing. If it's a vape pen, probably less so. So it's just, again, so many things going on that we need to understand. And back to EMA, we can ask in an EMA interview those questions, like what mode of use, what quantity, and again, that's a huge issue, but to the extent that people can report on quantity, you know, quantity, mode of use, who you're with, we can ask, are you sharing? And so forth, so that we can understand, oh, they're at a party and so they're sharing. Oh, they're at home in their room, so they're not, or what have you. It's just the level of detail that you can get with EMA is phenomenal. I have to make sure that people understand that with that detail comes many, many challenges for analyzing your data. So, you know, we focused on all the kinds of information that we can gather, but the issue becomes, how do you make sense of all of that?
Yeah.
I am not a statistician, and I take the wise course of action of finding people who are into stats and know all the newest modeling and so forth, like Mark Prince, for example. And work with them to analyze these data. But just managing all the data you can get from a month of EMA is gargantuan task. It really is. What have you found, Noah? Haven't you kind of run into that?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I think it's a whole, set of skills that are, I don't think, I guess, part of the run of the mill training, right? Like where you're dealing with, you know, in data sets I have, you know, tens of thousands of
observations,
observations per, you know, over the sample, right? You know, we have, you know, in some of the studies I do, they get, you know, between 5 and 8 random prompts a day.
Wow.
Per person, right? For, you know, 4 weeks for 100 people. Right. And then that quickly transforms into, you know, 20,000 rows or, you know, of data. And so there's some, you know, you have to really understand how to make sense out of that, how to manage it and software to do that. And then I think as the field moves more towards this, capitalizing on this medium of having mobile devices in everybody's pockets and being able to make sense out of that, I think big data is like an essential training that that students in our field, or even even investigators who are early career or senior, will need to engage in just to know how to manage all of this stuff.
Well, I want to make that point because to me, EMA research has to involve a team. You really need to bring together people who have different skills. I mean, obviously statistics and we're talking sophisticated approaches to analyzing data, you know, modeling and so forth. You might need interventionists, you might need, you know, people who can kind of understand what's going on biologically or pharmacologically or what have you. It to understand the data and the implications for whatever your next steps are, it really is important to collaborate. It's not something, you know, like when you were in training and you ran an experiment and you got the results and you ran some ANOVAs and it's like, oh, this is better. No, it takes a lot of time. And expertise to manage these data.
And there are just so many choices. I've played around a little bit with some EMA data and just deciding which variable to use, you know, in terms of the temporal order, which to put first, moment level data, day level data, week level data, person level data. And, you know, it is just wild. And that's the thing that has been shocking to me about EMA data is I like to use the term researcher degrees of freedom. It leaves a lot of opportunity for people to just make decisions. And it makes it, I guess, harder for you to know and replicate in some ways.
So I'm glad you made that point because it's really important not just to gather data randomly.
Yeah.
And the reason I got into EMA was because I had a particular theoretical framework that I wanted to examine. And that framework involved looking at change in affect before and after drinking and what would happen the next day and so forth.
Right.
I won't go into the details, but what EMA provided me with was an opportunity to really examine that model over time and within individuals. So collecting EMA data just to collect EMA data is not a great
idea. It's a bad idea.
It's a very bad idea because, you know, once you're overwhelmed by all this, you know, you could analyze it a gazillion ways and kind of post hoc, you know, mucking around and saying, oh yeah, there's a relationship there. We don't want
dangerous. It's dangerous.
We do not want to go there. So what is really important is to kind of do your homework and think about what phenomena you want to map by collecting this kind of very detailed data within subject data, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, time related issues are a great reason for collecting EMA data, but it's important to consider the conceptualization of your research and not just say, oh, well, I'm doing an intervention. Why don't I throw in some EMA? And it's...
Which it's not something you just throw in either.
No.
It's quite an undertaking to... I have prompts going off in my pocket currently for testing, you know, and there's a lot of decision points, right? Like how many questions, what time of day, what order are the questions going to be in, you know, like then there's, that's all just pre data analysis, right? On the back end, you know, at what level do we aggregate the data to, you know, are we looking at, you know, moment to moment changes, which makes sense for specific theoretical questions, which we want to answer, or, you know, within day, like morning to night changes or between days, or, you know, there's all these different timescale issues that are, I think are in important decision points that you want to iron out prior to any data collection, because then you can just get lost in the weeds of it.
I think another consideration is what you're putting your participants through.
Oh, yeah.
So you mentioned 8 random prompts and I'm like, my participants would not have put up with that. We try to keep the random prompting down to 3 or 4. And then, as I said, we ask them to report to us what's going on before and after they use. But the level of demand can be, I think, infuriating.
Oh, yeah.
To some participants. And so that's always the question, is the balancing act between what you're asking them to do and getting good real-time data and what kind of makes sense in the context of their lives. Yes, if all they're doing is sitting around waiting to be prompted, sure, but that's not how most people live. And so we need to consider, you know, all sorts of things. Like one of the things we realized early in our use of EMA was the importance of noise. So if people can't hear your prompts, they can't respond. Mm-hmm. So we had participants who worked in noisy environments and we had to essentially not include them in the study because we realized it doesn't make sense. You know, the other thing, I mean, just even defining a day, sleep wake cycles are wacky. And especially with young people, you know, they go to bed at 4, they wake up at 1 in the afternoon. When does your day begin? You know, so again, before you get to EMA, you really have to understand your participants and their lives and the phenomena that you're trying to study and how that fits into their lives and their lifestyle. Even our participants who are college students, you know, they might be in a course where they're not allowed to have a cell phone. And so, you know, they could tell us about that. But the point is, you know, we had to have ways to have them suspend. That's what we called it. Suspend interacting with the EMA protocol because they're in a business meeting or they're in a class or you're a surgeon about to do surgery. You probably don't want to be prompted or what have you. I mean, I made up the last example, but what it says is not every context is appropriate for that kind of data collection. And you have to understand the lives of your participants.
Well, yeah. And some of them, you know, are contexts that you might not expect cannabis use, like a surgeon. You might not expect them to be you. I'll say, I hope that my surgeon wouldn't be, you know, using cannabis as he's going into surgery, but some of them might be situations like driving, right. Where it might be relevant. And so these are a lot of really important factors that complicate it. Nonetheless, I mean, it's far more contextual information than we've really ever been able to get from any other methodology. And I think this is a really important growing field. Like you said, it's been used more often with alcohol use, alcohol studies, but It's sort of
wide and tobacco as well. Yeah. Yeah. It's actually Saul Schiffman. If you look up his work, he's one of the fathers. He and Arthur Stone were the two who really got EMA moving. And Saul has done decades of work looking at tobacco use.
Yeah.
So,
well, it's clear that it has a lot of potential, and there's a lot of room for it to be used in cannabis. And we really appreciate you coming on and just chatting with us about it for a little while. And we like to end each of our episodes just with sort of brief take home messages for our key populations. So are you ready for that?
I'll try.
You'll try. I'm sure you'll have some great things to say. So, take-home messages. What would your take-home message be for people who are in recovery?
In recovery? Wow. You know, even though I do interventions, it's typically to get people to lessen use rather than not use. And so the notion of recovery, which maybe I'm limited, but in my mind often includes abstinence, mm-hmm. is not something that I think about a lot. I mean, my idea is learn how to manage your use so that you can get whatever the positives are that you want without getting into trouble.
That's Alan speaking through you.
Oh, definitely. Yes. Yes. No, I have taken so much from Alan, but I completely buy into that, especially for young people.
I get
worried about, you know, an 18-year-old or even a 25-year-old being told you're in recovery and you should never use anything for the rest of your life. I just think that that's a setup for failure.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we've had Susan Collins on earlier, and Katie Witkowitz as well. And so we've had a few of Alan's people on.
Yep.
Katie come on specifically to talk about, well, maybe redefining what recovery would sort of look like for alcohol specifically. But I think that a lot of that stuff can actually be, cut and paste into these other substances. That recovery, so to speak, could be more general. So if you had to, I'll reframe my question here. So what would you say for people who are trying to cut down their use or who would like to sort of find that balance a little bit better?
Okay. I would say that one of the things is to balance your life so that it's not oriented around substance use. So in one of the interventions we did, where we did collect EMA data, it's the one I was talking about where we had people use an app. One of the conditions, we provided access to three physical activity apps and said to them, you know, physical activity has been shown to be helpful and, you know, use this in whatever way makes sense to you. And those who engaged in physical activity, again, these are young people, did way better. They did significantly better than those who did not. And I'm a huge fan of physical activity. I think we need to do a lot more work there to understand how it can, for example, affect mood. Go outside and take a run, or if gyms ever come back, go to the gym and spend some time on the treadmill, or whatever you do. It's really something that can help keep people balanced, especially around negative affect. So I think that that's really good. I think another useful thing is to kind of have variety in your friendships. One of the things that can happen is that people kind of develop peers, cohorts, whatever you want to call them, with whom kind of a primary activity is substance use. And so to the extent that your social life is oriented around substances, then you're going to end up in substance using context. But maybe, you know, you're also interested in cooking. Maybe develop friends who are foodies or who you take cooking classes with or what have you. I mean, I just think that variety helps. And to the extent that you can keep life in balance, it keeps you away from just focusing on substances.
What would you say to practitioners that are listening?
So for practitioners, I think I've already mentioned the pitfalls of EMA. Actually, one thing that's underutilized, it's not quite as intensive as EMA, but I want to make a plug for it, is daily data collection. So especially in the context of an intervention, it can be useful to have a link that the person fills out every day where you ask some of the questions you might ask in an EMA type survey, you know, and help people to kind of get a handle on what's going on a daily basis. Even understanding substance use on a daily basis, I think can be much more useful than kind of the retrospective guesstimating that people do, because daily data collection, although it involves retrospection, it is prospective, and you can, you know, again, develop graphs of, you know, your daily mood or your daily spending or your daily substance use. And that can be very, very informative. So if I were a practitioner, that's something, especially with technology, that's pretty easy. And it can serve as the basis for your next session. You know, if you have 6 days or what have you, and you can kind of look at the patterns of use and you can talk to your client about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's probably some money to be made in for a web developer or an app developer to create something that would act as an EMA device more or less, but then could aggregate it and analyze it for an individual, you know, week to week, so that you could use that in therapy. I don't know how to do that. I'm nowhere near it, but that sounds like a really good idea. And until then, these daily things, you can really look at the connection between, you know, mood. Oh, you used a lot this day, and the next day you seem to be really down. Stuff like that. So,
right. No, it's a great way of kind of getting a handle on what's going on so that you can discuss and provide feedback.
Yeah, absolutely. What would your take home message be for policymakers?
Oh my God. Can we please have a federal law?
Some regulation.
that allows for well-regulated cannabis use. I mean, the U.S. in its infinite wisdom has 50 different set of policies based on each state. And it just, this patchwork is chaotic. It's not helpful to individuals. I think it makes it harder to just develop a regulated or well-regulated industry, which in a way we need, because we have to be aware of the fact that when people get cannabis from illegal sources, it's completely unknown what they're getting. And one of the reasons I like regulation is if you do it well and if you do it right, you can test so that people know the potency of the product. You can stipulate the size of a serving. You can indicate the ratio of THC to CBD or whatever else. We need to have clear rules about what this product involves, what's in it, how potent it is, ways to use it, you know, whether it's medicinal or recreational. We need better guidelines.
I completely agree. And then allow, right, that I think opens the door for, I think, a lot better outcomes and a lot better research and all of these types of things.
So right now, federally, cannabis is Schedule 1, which is the same as heroin, meth, You know, just fentanyl.
Is cocaine scheduled? Isn't it scheduled two? I think it's like considered worse than cocaine. I don't remember off the top of my head, but
I can't comment on cocaine. I know it's the same as heroin.
Yeah.
And the issue, when you look at the guidelines basically say that it has no health benefits, that it's a high risk for developing, you know, addictions and use disorders and what have you. And we know that that's not true. And so, you know, that was done in the 30s. I teach a cannabis course and we start by having the students view the movie Reefer Madness. And that was made in 1936. And, you know, people laugh, but the message that was sent is that, you know, one toke and you're kind of on the way to madness and murder and sexual abuse and all these other things. And it's just like, that is not true. And so we need to get over that 1930s mentality and look around and see what's going on in 2021.
Yeah, agreed. Right. And I think it has to be a top down, like you were saying, like with alcohol, for instance, is a federal legislation that it, for the most part, that allows for standardization and regulation around potency and standard drinks and all that stuff that is just frankly missing. And before we start going up, letting industry just do their thing, we should have those guardrails in place, because it's hard to kind of put the air back in the balloon, right, if you will, if we do it. And we're already starting to see that in certain states, as you've talked about, like in Colorado, I think they did a study where they tested the potency based on the label, and it was just like, could not have been less accurate, right?
Yeah. but here's the problem. When each state does its own thing, it's very confusing to users, to obviously for research.
Yeah.
You know, it's... So Canada is a great example of a federal system. Yes, there are variations based on province, but the federal government decided on day X, you have access to recreational cannabis. And then, you know, they started with certain products. I know the most recently, in January of this year, they added edibles, and, you know, so there's been this gradual opportunity to introduce products and to provide public health education, because that's the other thing that's missing.
We
don't have good messages, and we really need that so that people understand what's going on. And especially because access to cannabis in the US started with medicinal, if you can call it that, in California in the 90s, which was basically a ruse, but let's call it that, that there's a lot of confusion in the public. Wait, this is a medicine, but it's illegal. And then the medical disorders that it supposedly can help are just proliferating. We've got a whole mess right now with CBD, which is not a product that people worry about because it doesn't have psychoactive properties. But we still don't understand, and people are giving it to their dogs, and they're putting it in creams and alcohol beverages. And it's like the Wild West out there.
Yeah.
We need to kind of get that under control.
Yeah.
Agreed. Yeah. I think it's a two-way street, I think, on the public messaging, right? Cause like, we need to understand what's going on with it, but also, right, historically cannabis laws have been used to kind of over police.
Yes.
Communities of color. And so I'm curious a little bit about what you think a take-home message would be for, you know, underserved populations or communities of color.
Wow. So the messages I'm thinking about are for everyone. But from a social justice perspective, it's even more important that we regulate, because to the extent, and New York State has a horrible history with this, mm-hmm. but to the extent that you can use the quote smell of marijuana in your car as a reason for putting somebody in jail, that is bad for all of society. And we know that somehow the smell in a low-income community is more common than the smell in a high-income community, even though both groups are using. So, so yes, if we had a federal law that said the access to this is not a crime, and you get a fine or a little slap on the wrist or whatever it is for having X amount for personal use, I think that would be great for everyone. But yeah, there is a whole kind of movement now for trying to use tax dollars from cannabis to help communities that have been disproportionately affected by cannabis laws, to help them to recover. And I support that, because they have suffered disproportionately, and it's important that state legislatures think about how they can help those communities to recover from decades of devastation.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been reading a book called Chasing the Scream by Johan Hari. And it's about some of the laws that were put into place in the 1920s and the 30s. And I can't remember his name, but this one guy in particular who worked for a government agency who is sort of the father of the war on drugs, and just how.
Oh, yeah.
Devastating.
I can't remember his name either, but yeah. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
It's just so devastating. And unfortunately, there are often a lot of reasons for the government to continue to do what has already been done. So I think it's our job as psychologists, but also just citizens to push for this change and to be informed about the effects of cannabis and why this legislation would be just a good thing to regulate. So
yeah. So the term marijuana is mostly used in the US, and it was introduced for racist reasons.
Mm-hmm.
It's Spanish. So the Mexicans used to use this plant. And the thought was, if we give it this foreign Mexican Spanish name,
yeah.
that will alert people to the fact that this drug or this substance is linked to the kind of degraded people. And it was brought about, oh God, I wish I could remember that guy's name, but it was brought about by
no, me too.
His kind of racist approach to substance use in what he thought were depraved people, whether it be jazz musicians, low SES communities, people of color, people who spoke a different language like Spanish. I try not to use that word because not only is cannabis the name of the plant, but it's not linked to the racism that the word marijuana is linked to.
Right. Right. I think his name is Harry Anslinger.
That sounds right.
I think that's it. But yeah, there's a terrible history. That's a really good book. Anyone who's interested in understanding that a little bit better, but we've got to do better. So Lorraine, thank you so much for coming on and talking about all this stuff. Teaching me. I'm sure there were times where I sounded or perhaps stupid during this interview. So thank you so much for all the work that you're doing, and you've been really successful. And I wonder if, you know, for the final question, if you have any advice for trainees out there who might want to follow in your footsteps a little bit.
Wow, that's a really good question. So everyone has their own journey. And so it's not as if I'm going to be able to provide specific guidance. But what I would say is hard work does play a role. You can't just say, oh, I want to do this and it gets done. You really have to make the commitment and work at it. I think collaboration, especially these days, is incredibly important. I learn from people in different fields all the time. Right now, I'm working with someone in electrical engineering, believe it or not.
Wow.
Be one of the more distant ones I hear.
Yeah, that's definitely the first time I've heard that collaboration.
it is distant, but he's doing something really interesting with developing a methodology for sensing drugs. And so I reached out to him and said, you know, this could have relevance for illegal substances. And so we actually submitted, I think it's an SBIR, like a small business thing.
Cool.
And we got scored. And so we're about to resubmit. But I'm just saying, whether it was Saul doing his stuff with smoking, and I thought, you know, that's relevant. Or so look for collaborators, be open, not just in your little I'm a psychologist world, but in whatever else is going on in the world. I love the fact that you mentioned, Sam, you mentioned that book you're reading. I do think kind of reading broadly and being curious is very, very important. That's where ideas come from. And sometimes when you read outside of your discipline, you actually learn things that you can apply. And then, you know, luck. I need to mention that. So, you know, I got an internship in Seattle and I like Seattle. And I was like, who here is looking for a postdoc? And my mentor from Rutgers said, well, you could go talk to Alan Marlatt. And I was like, no, I couldn't. He's a god. but eventually I found a reason to go talk to Alan Marlatt. Yeah. And he's a god, but he's also a great human being. And, you know, so that was lucky. Pursue opportunities as they present themselves, but also be prepared to work hard. Our lives are not easy lives. So you have to be prepared for that.
Busy and tiring. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Tiring, but also really rewarding.
Oh, incredibly rewarding.
Absolutely.
Incredibly rewarding. But, you know, instant success is not likely. So you have
wrong
to
field,
have...
right?
You have to have the stamina to stick with it. You have to have the confidence in yourself. And you have to, collaborators are great because you say to your co-I or what have you, does this make sense? Are we, you know, help me work through this thorny issue? Or you go to a colleague in another department and you say, I think what you're doing is relevant. Can you help? So be humble, be creative, just so many things. But know that you have to work at it.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Lorraine. This has been great.
Well, thank you, Samuel. Thank you, Noah.
Next time on the Addiction Psychologist podcast, in our student episode, we're going to have Laura Lesniewicz join us. Laura is a doctoral candidate in clinical psychology at Rutgers and a pre-doctoral intern at the Coatesville VA Medical Center. She'll be talking to us about her research on biomarkers and alcohol use disorder. After that, we're going to have Dr. Deborah Kaysen join us. Deb is a professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University Medical Center, and she'll be talking to us about her research focusing on alcohol use disorder and post-traumatic stress disorder co-occurrence.